In June 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a narrowly decided ruling, nullified a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, which was the crown jewel of the 1965 legislation for the civil rights movement. What is the impact of that Supreme Court ruling in 2013?
That's been a devastating impact. It's had an incredible impact on the way Americans view the court, the way that Americans view our country's commitment to Voting Rights Act, and on the ground, it has changed what states have been introducing by way of legislation. Let me elaborate a little bit. In our Constitution, through the 15th and the 14th Amendment, we make a promise to our citizens that they will be free from racial discrimination when they step in the ballot box. The Voting Rights Act was that manifestation, and for the better part of 50 years, it was doing that job really, really well. It did that through a number of provisions. The one that the Supreme Court nullified was what is known as Section 5. It's called the preclearance provision. And what the preclearance provision does is it has certain rules suggesting that if an election, if a jurisdiction that conducts elections wants to change their election system or change any rules about their elections, they have to get approval in advance from either a three-court judge in D.C. or the Department of Justice to demonstrate that that change was not going to be discriminatory, that it's not going to make minority voters in that jurisdiction worse off. And that's been incredibly important because it blocks discriminatory changes before they occur. And it also serves as a deterrent. Election officials aren't going to, or state legislators are not going to try and enact changes that have a discriminatory purpose or result if they know that it's not going to get through and it's not going to be something that they can implement. The Supreme Court decision struck down the formula that was used to determine which jurisdictions had to comply with this preclearance process.
So Chief Justice Roberts, who authored the decision, said that the data on which the rule had been based was outmoded and that it did not bear a logical relationship to the current facts of American voting. Was that incorrect?
The opinion was very disappointing because it ignored the tremendous amount of record that had been put before Congress. I want to be really clear about something. The Constitution says that Congress gets to make the determination about how to end racial discrimination in voting. And Congress had more than 20 hearings. They heard more than 90 witnesses. There were more than 15,000 pages supporting the decision that they made to extend the preclearance provision in the manner that they did in 2006. And
an extension that was signed by President Bush.
That is right, and had tremendous bipartisan support. The decision was very difficult for lawyers, scholars, academics to reconcile what is very solid jurisprudence about just how strong Congress's power is to make this determination. We need to remember how the 15th Amendment came about. By the time that it was ratified, we had already formally ended racial discrimination in voting. We had already said to the southern states that you cannot be back in our union unless you change your constitution such that you will not discriminate on the basis of race. The 15th Amendment was nonetheless still passed because it understood that racial discrimination in voting was dynamic. It was going to change. We were not going to be able to predict every measure that someone was going to come up with to try and make it harder for minority voters to be able to participate in a free and fair and accessible way. And that dynamism affords a certain amount of deference to the determinations of Congress. And prior to this decision, in numerous other cases, the Voting Rights Act and the method that Congress used to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act had been held up as the gold standard. It had been determined that Congress had built the record, and it had been lauded as a process that other national legislation that would be having effects on state determinations should follow, because it was thought to be so careful and so well considered. And in this case, the Supreme Court substituted its own policy determination as to who should be covered for what Congress did. But as a civil rights lawyer, I think it's really important that we move forward. That is the decision that we're laboring in. There has been a, the chickens are already coming home to roost. The state of North Carolina already passed a really onerous and restrictive Voting Rights Act. Voting bill, which did a number of things that are getting it challenged. There's multiple lawsuits in North Carolina currently challenging the bill that. That would not have gone through had there been the preclearance process. And there are actually legislators on the record, saying publicly, we were just going to do a photo identification bill, but now that there's no preclearance process, we can go with the whole package. So we know that there was a deterrence effect under preclearance, and we don't have that now. So we have to watch every single formally covered jurisdiction to see what their legislators have in store for them.
Why would it be in anybody's interest to reduce the ability of voters to register?
That is a good question, and I don't have a good answer. When one puts unnecessary barriers in front of the ballot box, that cheapens our democracy, that tarnishes a legacy of expansion and participation that we should be very, very proud of.
So, again, you'd have this whole group saying the barriers are not that difficult. Getting an ID in the year 2014 just ain't that hard. In your response?
It's not that hard for most people. It's not that hard for most people, but you know what? This is a democracy for all of us, not just for the 90 or so percent of us that do have access to an ID or can get one. We live in a country where all people are created equal and all have the fundamental right to vote. And if we have a barrier that makes it really burdensome for people to participate, that is a barrier that we should look at with careful scrutiny, and we should ask ourselves, is it worth it, and what are we getting in return? And certainly there are some laws, like for example the Texas law, where I think there's going to be a determination that it's not worth it and we're not getting enough in terms of the gains as we are compared to the people who are not going to be able to participate.
Let's discuss laws that prohibit convicted felons from voting. How many people are affected by those rules?
We think there's more than 4 million Americans living and working in our country that cannot vote because of criminal conviction. If you include people that can't vote because they're in prison, that's greater than 5 million.
And what is the effect on our democracy of that?
There is pretty good historical evidence that the states that have that many of the state laws restricting a person's right to vote because of a criminal conviction in their past derives from an attempt to disenfranchise people that had been formally enfranchised, through the Civil War amendments, and when you have large segments of our population who are largely minorities or disproportionately minorities, it does violence to our democracy in a number of ways. One, it denies people the opportunity to be stakeholders. It prevents people from being able to have a say in the way that they are governed and to be able to have a voice on par with their other citizens. It's bad for successful reintegration. There's a lot of experience behind the notion that if we want people who are released from prisons to be successful citizens and not recidivate, we need to fully integrate them. And that a person who votes is a person who cares enough about their community and about their family and about the way that the government runs to be able to make that kind of sacrifice of standing in line, getting time off of work, etc. And that is the kind of pro-social behavior that we want people who have had run-ins with the law in the past to be engaging in.
What is your position on felon disenfranchisement?
I think it is bad for our democracy. It is bad for our public safety. It is bad for the next generation of children to have people who are living and working in our community and be unable to vote. Many children learn how to vote by watching their parents, and if you have entire communities where the adults can't vote, the children aren't going to have anybody to take them to the polls on the election day or talk to them about the importance of voting. And I also, for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, think that it's really important that we give people returning to society the tools to be able to be successfully remaining there. And there's certainly some data that suggests that people who vote are less likely to recidivate. Like, people who have been given the opportunity to vote and choose to take that opportunity are less likely to recidivate. And it makes sense, because voting is a very pro-social act. It teaches you things like patience, and that there are certain rules of the game, and that you have to wait in line and wait your turn. And if you
hopefully
don't
not too long of a line.
Hopefully not too long of a line. And if you, and you have to accept outcomes that you may not like, and delayed gratification. I mean, there's a lot to voting, and that's good behavior that we want people to be experiencing.
To hear more episodes of Humankind, you can subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast player. A new episode each week. The podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you enjoy this program, be sure to leave us a kind review at iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to support the program, please visit humanmedia.org. And at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org. Thanks.